Welcome, everyone, to the X Factor Files podcast. I'm Daryl.
I'm Philip.
And we're here with the next rule of three, and our very special guest is Mr. Steve Orlando. Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really good and excited to talk because I do know what we're talking about. It's one of my favorite things. So
yeah. So, and it actually connects to work that you are actively doing right now. The year 2099 means something to Steve Orlando, obviously. And it's a, I'd say a fertile playground for ideas too, where you've been able to draw out a lot of material and do some really fun and exciting things through your writing, not only with Spider-Man 2099, but then we have Annihilation that just wrapped up last week. And then we have Conquest coming up this fall too, which is super exciting. So, did X-Men 2099 lead you to this place in your career?
Well, in a way, I mean, it's kind of always been there. You know, I was the right age for 2099. I was seven in 1992. And so, like, when Spider-Man and X-Men debuted, and Doom, and of course, all the other launch books, but like, they specifically for me, Spider-Man and X-Men, those books were just the coolest thing. You know, like, I was just right in the strike zone. And fast forward about 10 years later, and I started trying to break into this job when I was about 12. So by 2001, 2002, I was already, you know, talking to Marvel and DC in vain, of course, because I was but a child, but they were very patient. And the thing was, is I wasn't sure what I could pitch Marvel, because I was a big X-Men fan, but Grant was currently doing New X-Men. And I was like, well, what could I possibly do that would be that Grant hasn't touched and that would also be, you know, that would stand out, because New X-Men was such a strong vibe. I loved that run. And it came to me that, yes, I could do X-Men 2099, because it was decades in the future from what was going on in New X-Men. So I was sure that was going to be my in. I actually put together a pitch with Sonny Goh, who would go on to be a well-known colorist. But, you know, that did not work out, as you might imagine. In 2001 or two. But if you jump then an additional 20 years later, because my love of X-Men 2099 and Spider-Man was well known in the office, it ended up being me that wrote the 30th anniversary issue. So I was pitching what could have been, would have been a 10th anniversary type of relaunch. And by pitching, I mean, people were just shining me on. Again, I was like 17 years old at that time. but then I really got to write the 30th anniversary. So, and, you know, that's where we kick things off. A book in Spider-Man Exodus is what we're talking about. That's the 30th anniversary book that I thought, if I was never going to write this stuff again, I just had to have as much fun as possible. And that's why, of course, even though this was focused on Miguel, we of course had an X-Men issue, because I might never get to write these characters again. Right. So, I and it's still one of my two favorite 2099 issues that I've done now, many series in the future with more to come. So it's always kind of been there, you know, because I had this innate connection. I think there's something special when you follow a book or a set of characters from day and date, you know, like, not to say that I don't love other X-Men characters, but in the same way, you know, I've always felt when I was on Marauders, like, you know, why did you bring in Cassandra Nova? Well, I love a lot of X-Men characters, but I was there for her first issue. You know, like, I feel like I've been there the whole time. And I think there is something special about that. That's certainly how I feel about the 2099 roster. I mean, I didn't get to write them all because I haven't had a ton of time, but I could, you know, if there was a book I could write forever, it would be a cyberpunk future X-Men book. So hopefully someday.
Yeah, never say never, especially with Marvel and their investment in your vision of the future. It's really cool to see. I picked up the most recent work that you did in that world, sort of on a whim, where I'm like, well, I like Steve Orlando. And this is something new that is coming out with 2099. So let's give it a try. And it was encompassing and fascinating, and it was a lot of fun. So I can't wait for the new stuff to come out this fall.
I love that it's a carryover from when you were little and like you had the connection to those characters, and it's sort of, they have that special place for you.
And it, you know, it's rare that you actually get to work on those. I mean, the thing that I was pitching at DC at around the same time was Nightmaster. And I guess if you compare those two things, there was a slightly better chance I would someday work in a book with the name X-Men in it. Than Nightmaster, but you know what? I still like that pitch, so maybe someday.
Yes, again, someday. And to touch on just one more thing that's coming out this fall that I already wrote you about, you get to work in the Star Wars world. You've already contributed work to the Star Trek world, which is right up our alley. But Star Wars with Ewoks, especially. And I'm so excited because I got to show Philip Caravan of Courage. And he's like, what? Wait, what's happening?
What is this?
What is this? And why is that little girl somehow scarier than anything else on Endor?
Scarier than Wilford Brimley? Well, that's Battle for Endor, not Caravan of Courage. But
yep. Yeah. So anything that you can say about playing with Ewoks, our favorite interstellar teddy bears?
Yeah, I can say some things. I mean, so we realized, I mean, it's the 40th anniversary of Caravan this year, I believe. Now, like, I'm confident that's true, so I'm not going to Google.
It is true.
Because I was going to say, if it's not, then it's the 40th of Battle for Endor. So these are not direct adaptations. They're more like when we did the Life Day special a couple years ago, where we brought in elements from the holiday special that, you know, and canonized them within the Star Wars universe, recanonized them, if you will, because of the Legends maneuver. But it wasn't a slavish adaptation because not everything fit. You know, we built up the Life Day lore in that as its own sort of fleshed out holiday, and we cut like Jefferson Starship and Harvey Korman as Space Julia Child. Now, I would not have caught Harvey Korman in Space Julia Child drag, but that's a different discussion. but to that end, like, that's kind of, so we're doing a book that, yes, it focuses on the Ewoks, and it'll feel like Caravan. It'll feel like Battle for Endor in the sort of type of story it is. And at the same time, like the Life Day special, we are canonizing a lot of creatures and things that have never officially shown up. Now that things changed over, we'll be creating some new Ewoks, and we'll be bringing some in, actually specifically from the animated show, that have never been in, well, not live action, but faux live action, if you will, sure, in the comics before. So there's going to be new stuff. There's going to be, for folks who have been, you know, fans of the cartoon, fans of things like Caravan and Battle. I mean, we'll have a Gorax. You can't do Ewoks without the Gorax. You know, so like there will be a lot of stuff coming into canon for the first time, both new and things that you hopefully love, but when you're a little younger, now getting a fresh coat of paint for the modern Star Wars universe. And there'll be some classics as well. You'll see Zuckuss and Forlom there. Pardon me, for LOM, which I realized is how you say his name after years of not saying it out loud. When I was on a call with Lucasfilm, I was like, holy shit, I've been saying that wrong for 40 fucking years. But it's so for you know, but in all the classics, I mean, Chief Chirpa, of course, you know, bigger and small, like not everybody has a huge role, but of course Wicket is the lead, Chief Chirpa, Logray, Tebow, Princess Nisa, they're all there. But the big one is, as I said, like from the animated show specifically, Nisa's like feral sister Asha, who Paul Dini created, actually, like, and it, which makes a lot of sense when you watch the episode. It's basically, I'm going to give Endor a Batman, and then he would go on to, you know, give us all a Batman. But we're bringing her in, and there'll be some more surprises too.
Yeah, Philip stopped at our local comic store on the way home this afternoon and picked me up a Tebow. So glad he's like the spicy one too. So.
I don't want to, everybody gets at least a little moment, but yep, but it's only 4 issues, so not everybody gets the same amount, right, of screen. I can't lie to you, but it's been a blast. So hopefully we can do more. I'm actually writing the fourth issue. I'm finishing up after this call. So
nice. Well, we'll let you get to that. We'll dive into X-Men 2099 so you can
there's no rush, but that's what I'm working on today.
So. But X-Men 2099, you selected the first 3 issues of the series, and it's something I've read the first issue, because who's not drawn to a foil cover? But I haven't gone further than that before, and I think this was your first time, Philip.
It was.
Yeah. So,
there's two Gambits on the cover. Yes. What's happening?
The future's chock full of Gambits.
And the future is now. So we were just looking right before the call started at the cover of the first issue, and we're like, who are these people that didn't show up? Like, I feel the first issue sort of set the tone and gave you a bunch of characters to look forward to, not only in that premiere, but also throughout the first part of the series, where they're like, look at all these people, and we're going to make you wonder who they are. So you have to read the next issue. So how would you like to describe the first issue? Like, step us through you experiencing it for the first time. And then now, as you're looking back on it and reading it, how does it make you feel as a writer and a creative within the comics profession?
Well, you know, look, again, as a kid, my responses were what you would expect. I thought Skullfire was cool because his name was Skullfire, which actually wasn't his name in the book until, I think, until our 2099 issue, where he finally takes it as his mutant name. But so it was very base. I mean, I loved the action figures, and they were really cool when I was a kid. But as an adult, when I went back and read it for the first time, probably a couple years ago to work on this anniversary thing, I was surprised, honestly, by how ahead of its time it was, you know, like, and yeah, I mean, I love, like, I'm a huge mark for Ron Lim and pre super digital gradient coloring. So like the look of the book I love, but that's kind of subjective. What I think is really impressive, is a lot of the stuff you said, you know, like it doesn't just vomit everyone at you. It takes time for you to get to know the new characters individually. It uses Skullfire as a great way in. And as far as the first issue, I mean, I think that so much of what it talks about, this is a book that came out in 1992, and it has a somewhat prescient look at the future in general. I mean, but that's 2099 as a whole. But also, like, with what we want out of X-Men, you know, like, if you go to Cheyenne's speech about the people that led the X-Men in between Xavier and him, and you see, like, you know, this was 30 plus years ago, and you have this revelation that the leaders after Xavier and Magneto were going to be not white people, like, very obviously, like, this was a push in that direction years and years before folks really, really started talking about it. And that goes for the team as well. I mean, Cerebra, and I'm going to knock on wood, but to my understanding, is the first Indian mutant that there was. I mean, she's a historic character. And again, this was long before we started talking about this stuff. So I think it's ahead of its time in that respect. I think it's the same with intersectionality. Like when Cheyenne's giving his speech, you'll see that, you know, their hideout in Nueva Solar Ecology, is not just for mutants. Like they understand that, you know, like the forces of oppression and the forces of power, when they're done with one group, are always just going to move on to the other. So he's saying this is for outlaws, it's for degens, it's for mutroids, it's all these other groups within, you know, the future of the Marvel universe. So I was honestly, as a creator, I was even more impressed, because, you know, like, the art taste and things may vary, but the meat of the story is something that I think was decades ahead of its time. As far as what actually happens, yeah, I think using Skullfire as this thrown into the deep end neophyte is great. I could go on and on, and clearly I will. Like, I love that one of the first teams he meets is not a good dude. I mean, Junkpile is a piece of shit. You know, it's not,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
it's not like when you get to the Xavier School and everybody is there to welcome you and all that stuff. No, Junkpile is kind of an asshole and definitely a traitor as things go on. And it's just, I'm impressed, to be frank, by how messy it is. And I don't mean storytelling wise, I mean in character motivation and morally, right? Like, not all these characters get along. Bloodhawk runs off in them and everybody thinks he's an asshole too. It really is. I mean, I just think it's a lot more complex than I ever would have expected going back and reading it as an adult. And again, I just love that having a neophyte character isn't groundbreaking. I mean, that's what Kitty Pryde is. That's what Jubilee was, Pixie, I mean, take your pick. But I do think that the fact that it takes a while for him to sort of come around. I mean, he doesn't join the X-Men until the third issue. You don't hear the word X-Men until the end of the first issue. And I think that takes skill and craft and restraint that sometimes, honestly, like in, not even I can afford some as a modern creator, because we're in like the, we're in the Tumblr and TikTok generation where if you don't say X-Men in a splash by like the third page, or well, it would be the fourth page, then, you know, folks have kind of moved on. Right. So I just think it's extremely well done in a way that I think is, again, like folks could study and will and would have gone on, or will unknowingly go on to do, whether they knew it or not, for a long time. I mean, this is, I don't want to say it's decompressed because a shitload happens, but it really does take its time. As you said, you don't meet all the characters in the first issue. It breaks a lot of conventional rules, but because it's so confident in its world building and all this history is filled in and easy to explore, it's not decompressed, but it is fascinatingly paced, I would say, because you still get a ton of stuff. It's just that you are really taking your time in a way that a lot of modern books don't.
It's got a nice pacing in terms of action, in terms of character development. That was super nice. Like, I liked Crystalline's relationship with Henry / Mean Streak, because you get some of that in these first three issues of, yes, you have this team and they're sort of thrown together to work towards this goal of rescuing Xian, but also, I don't know, I just loved her line of, I suppose I should have paid more attention and not relied on Henry to know the layout of this place, since that's what he does.
Mm-hmm. And just the way, like you said, Steve, we were thrown into the deep end. Like, the first page is going to the refuge, and we, much like our Cypher character, don't know what's behind that big door with the X on it. Like, yeah, we know we're reading an X-Men comic, but...
I have the omnibus right here as well, so...
Yeah. Oh, nice. It's... You're really exploring the world through that character in a way that's sort of unlike Kitty Pryde or Jubilee, because we sort of already knew what the world was, and you're just getting to know different facets of the characters or settings through them. Here, we're really getting to know an entire world through a point of view character and getting to know the team from a very limited point of view as well. Like, it's beyond that one character, but still very limited in how we're introduced to things. And it's interesting where that point of view character is dragged along, just like, you're in this bullshit with us now, buddy. Like, come on, do you want to live? Because if you do, you're gonna have to come with us. That's the only option you have.
And there's enough world building in terms of the side comments too about the corporation wars and the syndicates, and it helps build it out a bit more.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
And I don't know if it's present in the omnibus. It probably isn't. The middle section of the first issue is also previewing all of the 2099 titles. So you get like one or two pages of Doom 2099 and Ravage 2099. So you sort of get a taste, because they want to draw you in to the entire world that's happening. And then confusingly, when I read this for the first time, there is the X-Men 2099 preview that is the first page for issue two. And I'm like, wait, am I supposed to read this now or later? What's happening?
That is classic 90s thought right there. No, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a whole middle section because they're like, do you want to see 2099 Unlimited and what the Hulk is here? There you go. And it has a green border, so you know that it's Hulk.
But I love Hulk 2099 too. That's a different podcast. I mean, I like a lot of, I'm not going to say that, I mean, be a broken record, I love all the takes, but I did like, I love the Monstrous Hulk design. We featured him extremely quickly in the Avengers issue of Exodus, but hopefully he can come back and fight the Red Hulk of 2099, who was one of my favorites from Annihilation.
Yes. So as we step through this first issue, what are the things that stand out to you, Philip? Like, what elements in this issue where you're like, yeah, that's intriguing, it's something I want to read more about or know more about?
No one came across as overpowered in any way. Shanti was like, oh, I can do these telepathic things, but only a little bit at short range for a few people. Eddie has to be in contact with the different metals in order to change. If Mean Street goes too far too fast, he starts smoking. So I like where there's bumpers for them to hit up against and how they can more subtly use their powers to get what they need done. I sort of like that where it's not just, I have all the power in the universe. Like, no, you don't. You have to work with what you got in new and creative ways. That's fun to see. And I really liked the line where it's like, we have Xavier's dream, we have Magneto's, or how to fight, and then a couple other folks. It's like, it's an amalgamation that created this new society in the arcology.
Yeah, and even there, they're sort of making do with their powers. I mean, you have Eddie using his powers as a DJ, basically.
That was great.
With the different metals and working with different vibrations.
Is he a theremin? Because that would be amazing.
That's fun.
When I write him, he fucking is. I will tell you that.
Yes. And sort of like the seedy underbelly of society, too, where you see that the ruling class, at least in Nevada, real scummy, but also having their own power struggles, too.
I like Desdemona. Like, she just planted a kiss on Bloodhawk to be like, I'm doing this just to bother my brother.
Yes. She's serving, and I appreciate it. I have all of this in a short box in the basement, and now I really want to read through to see where the characters end up, too, to see who I can then bother you about. Like, hey, have you thought about this character? And your answer is going to be, yes, I have. Just because it's such a rich cast within the first issue, then you roll into the second one and you still get more elements built into it.
Yeah.
Well, and it's risky too, you know, like for folks who are reading, you know, like, again, like it's risky. It pays off in my opinion, but it's risky to not intro the whole team. It's risky to intro your leader and then have him essentially be comatose for the next two issues. I really like Xion. I mean, I liked him as a kid. I haven't gotten him into a 2099 thing yet again, but, you know, if you want to talk about like thematics and things like that as a leader, I mean, Xavier having telepathy as a teacher, I think is thematically very interesting. You know, it's I don't know that Stan and Jack, especially Stan, thought about that in the 60s, but, you know, he is molding the minds of his students. That's what a teacher does. And that's also quite literally his power. But I think thematically it works really well with Xian's powers as well, because after he comes out of his chrysalis, because what can someone who is a mentor or a teacher or a leader do but create or destroy, right? So having a hand that can do both, I actually think is, I mean, again, as a kid, I thought it was just cool because he could touch things and make them explode or, you know, dissolve, because when you're seven, you're an idiot. but as an adult, I actually think that I really like his character. And he goes on a road too, without spoiling it. I mean, he is another thing that I think I really is again, risky, but pays off in this book, is that characters really do, we're going ahead of the first three issues, but like, characters do change and they're fallible, you know. I mean, like, and you see that with Junk Pile in the first first arc. You know, I would even argue he really tries to be one of the good people, but he can't, you know, like he's his own worst enemy. And you'll see like characters have major falls from grace in X-Men 2099 and in the long run, and some of them don't come back from it, you know. And again, that's a risk, because real change is sometimes sort of cataclysmic for the readership, but I think it pays off here. I think it makes them, it's antithetical to say, or I should at least say contradictory to say, because they're in a future. But I do think in a way the characters are very relatable, because they screw up all the time. They don't always have all the answers. And it's interesting. I mean, for me, even rereading it, like you said, this first issue, all you see is this one guy walking up to a room with a giant fucking X on it with mystery inside. That to me is like quintessential subculture, quintessential X-Men. And you know, I mean, listen, I worked in the Krakoa era. It didn't, I mean, I don't know that it always feels like that, like, but a lot of it is via tone, you know. It doesn't, I mean, obviously mutants were under siege from orcas worldwide. I can't say anything other than the aesthetic of it really being like this literal underground secret password subculture, I think it is really intriguing to me. Which at least is not to say we didn't have that stuff in Krakoa, but it plays out differently here. And I've at least as a reader, was drawn in just like the character Skullfire is, because it feels cool. It feels like a thing you want to know more about.
Yeah.
I flash back to going to Rocky Horror Picture Show for a midnight show for the first time when you say that. Like, you go out to a big scary door, you don't know what's behind it, you don't know what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, yes, it's analogous to a lot of experiences we have, especially, but that happens when culture has to exist, like, on the fringe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, storefronts that are holding some secret club but look like a fucking shoe store, you know. Yeah.
So, is that a Sainted Love reference?
That
oh god, you know, it is, but it wasn't even on purpose. It was actually the first bathhouse in the country is in Los Angeles, and when you walk by it, I mean, it, you would not know it was there. And I, you know, but like, that's actually what I was thinking of, but unexpected Sainted Love reference, I suppose.
Yes. Which we loved and followed.
That was one of the things that's like, oh my gosh, you get to talk to Steve Orlando, all these things that I randomly picked up and then just really liked, like Sainted Love and Commanders in Crisis. And which is also thanks to a David Tulaski cover, who's doing such good things.
David, yeah, listen, my little boy is all grown up. I met him years ago at Rose City, and knock on wood, I think we gave him his first comic work, not on Commanders, but actually on Project Patron at Aftershock, and then we did Commanders. But no, he's been blown up, and it's well deserved. He's incredible.
Absolutely.
And yes, he gave us two prize fighter covers that were very well done. That being said, this is a non sequitur to an extent, but also not. As we're on this podcast, I just had the spinoff I'm doing for Sweet Paprika announced at Image. It's going to come out this fall. But if you like Sainted Love, this is it's an LGBTQ plus spinoff of Sweet Paprika. It's still an office sex comedy. It's not full on like Sainted Love is, but it's my favorite thing I've ever done. So, and we do have a Nick Robles cover, I think for issue 2. There's a lot of great cover work, but it's a killer, killer book. And the announcement came out, you know,
hours ago,
within the past hour.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a whole row of Sweet Paprika at Comic Book College.
Oh, so everyone can catch up before your spinoff comes out.
Yeah. Well, if you read, so Sweet Paprika Black, White, and Pink, which was just up for an Eisner this summer, is Ooh. Where these characters debut. So we're taking the characters from the short I did there. Same artist, same everything, except we're full color now. And let me say this, there are things that I've certainly never seen on a comic page before that are in this book. So we are breaking new ground, in many ways.
Heard it here first, folks.
Yes, and by first, this is coming out in 6 days. So, hey, it's first if you go back in time and we're in this recording session. If we want to bop over to issue 2, what I really appreciate about Bloodhawk is that he is such a great character in these issues, where you see him in the first issue being victimized, like he's going to be executed, and he manifests and then is like, well, thanks for the save, peace out.
Yeah.
And then he comes back, he's like, fine, I owe you. But then he goes a little bit extra and he's like, well, now you owe me. So the characterization, I think, of a lot of these characters, it's not purely good or purely bad. It is the whole spectrum of gray is present in these characters as well, where you want to root for the X-Men. I mean, it's 92. The biggest selling comic of all time came out a year prior with X-Men. So it's a hot property, and all the fans are like, X-Men, yes, I want to cheer for them. But the elements of these characters where you're like, I don't know if they're entirely that good of a person. Or what are their intentions? Like, are they being selfish? It's very interesting in terms of how the board is set and how the pieces are moved around through the writing.
No, I mean, I agree. And I think that they do a good, I mean, so it's funny, like you said, it's 1992. You're right. It's 1992 in a lot of ways. And another way that it's that year is that everybody, I would say that 35% of the industry were Wolverine knockoffs. And the thing about it is like, obviously Bloodhawk's name is Bloodhawk. Like there's a fair amount of 90s to it, but I think that he fills a role in the team similar to Wolverine and Thunderbird actually, but in the obvious way, in that he's a feral guy with claws, but more importantly, which a lot of the other ones miss, is like, that's actually having claws and being a cutty slicey guy is actually less important than the character role that Wolverine fills or the Thunderbird filled, which is that, you know, he's going to press the buttons. He is the loner, of course, but as you saw, like, he's not immediately on board. He doesn't mind, you know, calling shit out when it happens, and he's not impressed. He's not impressed by the X-Men and all these things. He has his own strong motivations himself. And I think, you know, everybody likes the obviously slicey aspects of Wolverine, but I think when you're building a team, the important thing about him is that, like, yeah, he is the guy that he's there, but he's not a follower. Yeah, it's the reason he's been calling Charles Chuck for 50 years.
Yeah.
So I actually think Bloodhawk, yeah, he is great. And it's great because he fills that role in a substantive way versus just like an all sizzle and no steak way, an obvious way. And I think that in a way that's even more important, right? Like he's a disruptor on the team, and that's what Wolverine is really there for. He's there, of course, to solve things by cutting them apart, but he's really there to cause tension, and mm-hmm. That's why we love him, right? Because Wolverine is going to call bullshit out when he sees it. And that's always kind of been, I think, one of his key aspects. And it's great. And I like Bloodhawk for that a lot.
Someone else who disrupts is Desdemona at her father's funeral. She is drunk. She has a gun. And she's not pulling any punches.
No. And she knows something's up with her brother.
Yes. So it was interesting where the more I read of her, of course she's a queen. But also she's no bullshit and is able to peel back layers of this crime syndicate that no one else is willing to do.
She knows what she's entitled to, and then, yeah, works towards it, figures out what's happening with the brother.
Yep.
And then by the end, yeah, she has her team, she has her syndicate, she has the syndicate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those, like, oddly generous, I'll let you go this time, but I'll never come back.
Yeah.
So maybe as a thanks for setting everything up so she could dispose of the brother and take power for herself.
Yes. The heavies are the Rat Pack, which is very in line with Nevada. So playing into like the 20th century when this came out, creature of its time, of 92, where that name has recognition. I don't know if we could get away with bringing someone out or a group out called the Rat Pack these days, because the recognition of that cultural phenomenon might be too far removed.
It would be the Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
But actually,
yes.
I don't know if Sean Spears is famous enough to carry the chairman forward.
Oh, room. So
I understood that reference. Anyway,
yes, Steve Orlando, famous wrestling fan as well. We are as well. We talk about it all the time in our indie shows that we go to. So
Blood, Sweat, and Beers is Sunday.
It is. Matt Cardona is going to be there. So,
oh my god, the neighbor that inspired Somnus as an older gay man, and as well, and you know, I wrote Somnus because I couldn't give him a real second chance. But to that point, I did bring him to an indie show, and all he could talk about was Cardona. So I actually got him a signed 8x10 for his 70th birthday from Cardona.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Which I assume that he is laminated at this point so that he doesn't. But yes, it's funny. Matt has a very, he has a wide fan base, but also a very specific one in some cases.
Yes.
He's a big beefy man. My fiance loves him too, but less for that and more that he sells foam fingers, giving the middle finger.
Oh, that it is fun.
And yeah, because fiance is from New Jersey, that's like how we say hello to each other.
Oh. As we go into the third issue, the third and final issue we're covering, we're covering Alpha Flight on our podcast as well. And the episode that came out yesterday is issues 11 and 12 of Alpha Flight, issue 12, famously, Someone's Gonna Die. X-Men 2099 accelerates it by saying that in issue 3 that someone's going to die.
They do it in a quarter of the time of Alpha Flight.
Yeah, they do. They press fast forward, and this is where we sort of, it's the first three issues are like an arc that we're seeing throughout the story, where we're getting payoff for the team really coming together. And one of those team members leaves at the end of it.
Yeah.
So, Philip, were you surprised by anything?
Yes, I wasn't expecting. I thought Tina was the intro character of like, hey, let me show you around, like sort of the guide. And so I was not expecting it to be her.
Yeah.
Serpentina. She could have had a secondary mutation of turning things into stone, because there's a stone called Serpentine. And that would have been fun.
I think she would be a legend if she came back today. And maybe, you know, I considered having her be resurrected somehow in X-Men, but we need more time. Like, there are a lot of plans, but I think it works. I mean, I think it works great to establish the stakes in a way. Once again, like, we're on an accelerated time scale here, but it is kind of like losing Thunderbird, early on. Like, you realize, oh, this is not Avengers. I mean, obviously people die in Avengers, but they usually get better.
Yeah, there's stakes right away.
I think it's risky, but that's what I like about this book. It does leave you wanting more, because once again, here I am 30 plus years later, and I get on the book and I'm like, could we bring back Serpentina? She got her shot. But I think that's smart work on the part of the creators. And that continues, to be the theme, as we don't want to spoil too much, because the hope is that folks check the run out, especially because it's available in Omnibus now. But it continues. I mean, real things happen, like that are not reversed. I mean, Metalhead gets grievously injured and changed, and that does not get changed back. Like, that is his new state. It's kind of like when Beast was, at least for a long time, stuck being a blue, ape person. Mm-hmm. But I like that. I like that things have real stakes and real change happens. And I think that that by the end of these three issues, what this book is. It's a book where even if you like someone, anyone is on the in danger. And that despite the setting, these are going to be the messy future X-Men in a way that's very appealing.
And for me, the title really feels like it's about survival. I mean, to an extent, many X titles are, and many eras of the X-Men are. But this one, I feel that those stakes are heightened so much because it is so dystopian, and the power imbalance is incredible in this world. So you really get that they're fighting for their lives, literally, as they're moving through and just trying to have a safe space within this world that they had and was destroyed in the first issue. So
yeah.
It really is a journey that I feel that you're getting into with this cast of characters.
It feels a little ahead of its time in terms of, or like foreshadowing, given where we are politically with the whole corporation as people situation.
And 2099 in general, like, you're right. That's one of the reasons I think the books are great even now, even if the art is up and down, or I shouldn't say up and down, but if it's not what folks expect from modern comic book art. But like the corporate stuff, the card system, which I used in Exodus, is not something I created. I mean, here 30 years ago, you were having Nueva York, where there were, the class system, socioeconomic class was like hard enforced, and the black cards, the top, literally did not have to obey the law. So, I mean, we're living it right now.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, but it is impressively, it's not as dead on as like, Who's the dude that made Metal Gear Solid that has like accidentally predicted the future repeatedly? I'll look up. Well, anyway, yeah. Like he's kind of known for getting it surprisingly right. But I don't think it's quite there, but a lot of it is like, wow, this really is dead on.
If the folks who did, Sapphire Show with the corporations, and it's similar, like group of people existing on the fringe, and they had lost all their memories. Dark Space, maybe. I don't know. It was
Dark Spaces. I think was a show.
Yeah, they had like the similar setup with like these massive corporations, and then there's people on the fringes trying to find a place, and these folks coming together, and there's other mysteries involved on that too. But
there's got to be something, you know. I feel like in the early 90s work post like nuclear paranoia or something, because I was actually just, I can't work in silence. So I always have something on in the background, which is a lot of my peers are the opposite, and respect, I would go crazy. But I put on, there's a cartoon of the Phantom. So I love the Phantom, called Phantom 2040, from the mid 90s. It's also, as you might imagine, dystopian, takes place in the year 2040, which at that time, so long in the future. kind of like how Thundar took place in the far-flung future of 1994. But anyway, at one point, like this, one of the villains, who again owns this mega corporation, is talking to this news reporter and says, like, she just kind of says, "Well, I own the news, so the news is what I say it is." And I was like, "This was like 30 plus years ago."
Yeah.
And I was like, damn. So maybe there was something, as we like, you know, maybe that was the next big monster in the zeitgeist, you know, corpo stuff, after we got done worrying about nuclear Armageddon for 30 years. Who knows? I was not young enough to really have an opinion.
Yeah. Just
being terrified of the nuclear bomb scene in Terminator 2. There is that. But it is. They, you know, to this day, I think that when we work in this stuff, 2099 is kind of it its own sweet spot. I'm biased, of course, because I love it. And I love, like, I mean, I'm a dark future person. I love Future Trunks and Dragon Ball. I love, you know, Days of Future Past and all those things. But I kind of feel like the world of 2099 exists in this liminal state where it's just plausible enough and presented just tangibly enough. Because I love, like, Here Comes Tomorrow, for example, as well, if you want to keep it on X-Men. But I feel like that was like 4 to 5 points more towards like wastelandy, like the like normal people don't exist. I almost think that the world of 2099 is a little more horrific because normal people absolutely exist and live normal lives while all this other shit is going on.
I agree.
Yeah.
And that's why I want to read more. And how we sort of tackle these rule of threes is at the end of the episode that we're nearing. We sort of talk about, like, do you want to learn more about a specific character or title? And yeah, I want to go grab the rest of the run from the basement after this so I can keep reading, because it's not that long. Like, as you said, the omnibus is out and everything's in the omnibus.
I think
it's all of the issues. And we're waiting on confirmation from an owner of the omnibus.
Oh my god, it has giant versions of the 2099 trading cards and stuff.
Ooh, well. Wow.
I was chucking. Later on, you will meet one of my favorite things that is not in the opening. Once you get to X Nation, mm-hmm. It continues to be Buckwild. On here.
Yep.
The Sisterhood of the Howling Commandments, which are the guns that defend mutants, like paramilitary allies, I guess, if you will. So this looks like it has everything except maybe like there's a couple specials. Like there's a fully painted special that Greg and Tim Hildebrandt did. Mm-hmm. This appears to have like 99.9% of everything.
All right. And I always direct people, if you love omnibuses, go to places like Cheap Graphic Novels or In Stock Trades. Because you can get them at affordable prices rather than retail, and you're still supporting a small business and you're supporting the publisher. So, absolutely. All right, as we're wrapping this episode up, Steve, what would you like to promote? This is coming out next week, so anything from now until whenever that you want to chat about.
Sure. Well, you know, as you had said, 2099 Conquest is coming up. It is, we've been doing these runs that are essentially a series of one-shots, introduce characters. This is a full-on event, so it will not be that. It'll bring together folks from Earth. It'll bring together Spider-Man, Spider-Woman. It'll bring together Cyclops and Phoenix 2099, who I got to create, but I'm extremely partial to. along with some, but it will also feature appearances from some 2099 X-Men that have never appeared under me before, when they're still on Earth. So they'll be coming together. Folks from the horror issues will be there. Folks from Annihilation will be there. And it's just a big, cosmic blow up, that feels very different from Blood Hunt. I mean, I loved Blood Hunt, and I was writing this Dracula event in parallel. So, I wasn't going to out darkness and spookiness Jed, because they did an amazing job. So we are leaning into the opposite side of Dracula, which is like the leader, the nation builder, the tragic monster, and all those things. We're really positioning him sort of similar to John Milton's Lucifer, which is often thought of as the first romantic hero in fiction. He's doing a righteous thing in a terrible way, and I think that makes him really, really compelling. And he'll be fighting someone even worse. You'll find out about Spider-Woman's, you'll find out more about her home species, the people that were so terrible that she's the only person to ever leave their planet and come to Earth. So I'm really, really excited about that. And that will hit in the fall. As I just said, you brought up Sainted Love, like Sweet Paprika open for business. I've never had this much fun in a book. You know, I don't know what else to say. It's a blast. It is raunchy, but it's also got a ton of heart. Kind of the same feel, the same alchemy that we'd had on Sweet Paprika. That's coming out in the fall. And as you said, Ewoks also starts in the fall. I mean, I've been really lucky to be part of that. Laura Braga and Alvaro Lopez are doing just killer, killer work. They're splitting each issue. It's gorgeous. And you'll meet some new Star Wars characters there. You'll meet some new Ewoks, and you'll meet some new bounty hunters along with some classics. And I've just, like I said, I'm lucky that almost everything I'm working on right now has just been a ton of fun. And hopefully that comes through in the page. You'll be seeing it in the fall.
Great. People can find you online. Instagram, is at the Steve Orlando, right?
Yes. And the same for Twitter. And people do find me all the time. So. Great.
So if you want to be a part of the masses that are finding Steve Orlando, find him on social media and let him know that he's doing a great job. And get out there and read some X-Men 2099 to prepare yourself for whatever may come in Annihilation Conquest.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Steve. And everyone listening, we will catch you next time.
Be well.